Jim Labenthal is an investment advisor representative of Cerity Partners and holds the Chartered Financial Analyst designation. Jim Labenthal and Cerity Partners are unaffiliated with Stephen Weiss. The securities discussed in this podcast by Jim, unless otherwise stated to the contrary, are securities that Jim either manages within the current client portfolios or owned by Jim personally. You should not consider the information discussed as personalized investment, tax, or legal advice, or a solicitation to buy or sell any specific security. There's no guarantee that views and opinions expressed in this podcast will come to pass or a guarantee of future performance. Investing involves risk, and before investing, you should consult a qualified professional advisor. Stephen Weiss is not a registered investment advisor and is not affiliated with any regulated entity. The views and opinions he expresses are his own and are not intended to be advice or recommendations. Stephen does not guarantee the accuracy of his statements or views. Investors should perform their own due diligence and not rely upon the information contained in this podcast as the sole basis for their investments.
So here we are, Jim. It's Monday, the Monday before Thanksgiving, and I'd say that this is not your typical Monday in front of a holiday weekend. There was a lot going on today, and most of it was good, and there was 5 minutes that really turned somewhat sour. So let's just recap briefly, and then I'll turn it over to you. Futures look strong. Bonds looked sort of like, I'm talking about the 10-year, that's what we'll talk about, refer to bonds, looked under control. And then they started to edge up. And as they started to edge up, the market pretty much ignored it. So you had the Dow up 300 at one point. You had the S&P up, what, 25 or so, 30 maybe? And you had NASDAQ even up over 100. So nice percentage moves, not huge, 1%, give or take a little bit. And then the Powell news hit. And I guess there was more in the market for Brainard becoming the next Fed chair with the belief that she was going to be more dovish, because all of a sudden the 10-year ripped. The yield went up at one point over 80 bips, and I think that's where it closed. And it's not a big level, but it's always the velocity and the move, the compacted move of the 10-year, of rates, that hits the market. So what we wound up with was a market that sold off at the end of the day with the Dow barely staying in positive territory and the other indices getting hit. But I would have thought it would have been a better day starting out, and then dreams were dashed. So what was your take on it?
Well, the biggest thing I would note is cyclicals were back on today. I mean, they were back on in force, financials, energy, big time financials, industrials a little bit more. And as you point out, tech, not so much. NASDAQ down, the hyper growth stocks down. So you are correct in bringing up the Fed. That was definitely a major mover today. I was glad to see Jay Powell nominated. I actually don't think Lael Brainard would have been a bad choice, except for one thing: continuity. Right now, you want the same hand on the tiller. This is not a time to go changing the leadership, and then the message gets garbled, and the committee doesn't maybe act as much in unison as it otherwise would. This is a time that the message needs to be consistent. But also, Steve, there's something else underneath the surface here that's important to me, and I'm not sure everybody's paying attention to it, which is what's going on with COVID. Now, you know that over the last couple of months, I've been saying Delta has and is waning, okay? That is true. The variant has waned. However, starting to see case counts pick up again, both here in the U.S. and globally. And I think the last 3 weeks, you've seen the cyclical trade really falter on that news. Now, over the weekend, you got news that Europe, Austria, going into some form of lockdown. Other modified
huge
lockdowns.
Trading partner, Jim. Huge trading partner.
Well, let me finish the point here, which is
what do they make pretzels? We import pretzels from
hang,
there? Or?
Hang on a second there, Mr. Happy. Let me just make the point here, which is that now, whatever wave this is, fourth, fifth, I don't even know, of COVID, the impact of COVID on the global economy should be less and less for a few reasons. Okay. First off, there are these pills out there from Pfizer and Merck. And this Pfizer pill, 98% efficacy in keeping the at-risk population out of hospital, that changes the game. Okay. Now we're not talking about a death sentence for those people who are over 65. You're talking about you got a cold.
Those people over 65 aren't the workforce. They're not the ones that shut down the plants.
Don't take away from the point, because this is important. COVID and its impact on the economy and the markets should be waning. So, Steve, when I tell you factually the last 3 weeks that the cyclical or reopening or value trade, whatever you want to call it, has faltered because of this recent wave of COVID, I also tell you in the same breath that the market is getting that wrong. And today's reversal, where you saw energy, financials, and industrials rip, is what's going to happen from here into year end and probably well into the first quarter.
Let me respond to that a little bit. And first of all, I was remiss not in the opening complimenting you. I believe you're wearing a different shade of khaki today.
I like so my khakis.
For you, that's fashion forward. So congrats for stepping out of your box.
Khakis, Brooks Brothers, Oxford blue shirt. I mean, I know my uniform.
You do know your uniform. And what would you be without a uniform? Plaid wouldn't work on you. So look, here's what I'd say. Obviously, COVID was an overhang, and that's why we saw the 10-year trade with a 1.4 handle briefly, mostly a 1.5 handle. I disagree with you in that it was really laying on the industrials, aside from the airlines, which S&P classification are industrials. It definitely hit the travel stocks. But here's why I disagree, because it was hitting everything. The NASDAQ was having a terrible performance. Everything was going astray and just basing into what was thought to be a more aggressive move by the Fed. Because if you take a look at what was pulled forward in terms of rate hikes, it was pulled forward all the way to May. And then as COVID hit, it got pushed back to September, and also thought that Brainard, again, perceived to be more dovish, and I don't believe that's true, by the way, was also pushing it back. And then today, we had it pulled forward again. So look, you have to keep to your point, which you're making, is that you have to stick with what your view is. However, I don't think COVID was an overhang in the market for months and months. It just hasn't been.
I'm going to disagree with you. No surprise. I'm going to use facts because that's what we do. Last 3 weeks, the equal weighted S&P 500 has woefully underperformed the headline S&P 500, which, as we know, is market cap weighted and very much tilted towards large cap tech. Now, top 25% of the market cap weighted index is, as we know, it's Microsoft, it's Apple, it's Amazon, which although it's consumer discretionary, I say is tech. It's Google, which is communications, but should be tech. I could go on and on. The point is being this. In this last 2 years, whenever there has been concern about economic growth slowing down, primarily due to COVID, but any time that we've had a concern about economic growth slowing down, investors flock to these names, as they have, frankly, over most of the last 7 years. The perception being that if growth gets scarce, these are the only companies that are going to grow. In the last 3 weeks, that narrow leadership has been typified by NVIDIA, up 42%. And by the way, these are the 3 weeks closing on Friday, this last Friday, the 19th. NVIDIA up 42%. Amazon up 11%, Apple up 8%, Tesla up 11%. The point being is that that narrow leadership to me has been representative of COVID fears. I think, again, let me be clear. I think you get this, but I want to make sure our listeners get this as well, okay? Is that I think the COVID impact is waning. I'm going to make a comparison. To me, this is being reminiscent of 10 years ago, the European peripheral crisis. Remember that? Remember, it seemed like the end of the world. Let me finish. I see you. Listeners can't see you, but I see you ready to pounce. Just hold your horses, okay? 10 years ago, the peripheral crisis in the European Union threatened to break that up, and it went on for years, okay? It went on for years and years until Mario Draghi said, enough, we're saving the union, we're saving the euro. I submit to you, imperfect analogy, but I submit to you, these pills from Pfizer and Merck, same thing as Mario Draghi saving the euro, saying he'll do whatever it takes.
I'm going to disagree with you because I don't want us both to be wrong. So here's what I'd say. It doesn't compare to that. And if you take a look at the stocks that you pointed out, they were event-driven stocks. NVIDIA was trading up because every analyst in the world, every single analyst saying they're going to blow out the quarter, you got to get in front of it. You got to get in front of it. And we saw that there was data center strength from other components of the S&P that reported. So that brought him into NVIDIA. In terms of Apple, well, Apple is launching new products, and Apple was really a catch-up move. Keep in mind, it fell down. But you have Facebook. Nobody went to Facebook. As a matter of fact, over the last couple of weeks, Facebook was down. And of course, it's down because it's event-driven. So I don't think that's the case where they're flocking into. To me, the money that drove those stocks higher is, according to, I think it was B of A, new money coming into the market and going into tech, not money rotating out of your beloved industrials or cyclicals into tech. So we can't draw these conclusions from what are really short-term blip moves. But I'll tell you one thing where we are going to agree is that you got to be out of your mind or have money to burn to want to own the Snowflakes of the world, to want to own the CrowdStrike, to want to own these companies that trade on 100 times revenue or 150 times revenue and have no earnings or have earnings that are at a 200 PE. Now, there'll be exceptions, and those exceptions will be companies that have historic valuation parameters that are more mature traders, like a Tesla, which, of course, we believe is overvalued, you and I, but it's always traded overvalued. Amazon, it's a highly valued stock, although not as much as it used to be. So that'll be protected in terms of the historic maturity of it. But those new ones, the Snowflakes of the world, they will not, which is why I am short, not periodically short, even though I think she's a great investment manager with a completely foreign discipline to me, Kathy Wood, I'm short the ARKK. And thankfully, I was able to get a borrow. A lot of times when I go to short it, the borrow is very difficult. I'm also short the Qs. I tried to short the SMH. I was short it coming into today, foolishly covered because it was a good trade. Tried to short it out again. The borrow on the SMH, that's a semi-index, got very, very tough. So very difficult. Now, I just think that that's going to be a suicide play. And I just want to throw something out there that you and I can agree on.
So as a seasoned investor, which we both are, I respect and admire your willingness to short the ARK Innovation Fund, ARKK.
But they're short term. They're tightly showing their stops.
You got to have your stops. Okay, good. Because obviously this can move against you, but I agree with you. I want to do a favor for our listeners here because you listen to all these stocks, whether it's ARK or you mentioned CrowdStrike, I forget what else you mentioned. Sometimes our listeners will look at these stocks and say, but wait a second, these are fabulous companies. I really kind of want to own them. What do I do? Here's what you do. Identify one or two or three and take a toehold position. This is what I've done with Salesforce and Twilio. And we talked about that on the show today. We can get into that a little bit later, but let me make this very strong point. If you really believe in these companies, don't load the boat, okay? That is the way that you can get demolished. And yes, you can make riches too, but the way to do this is take a little bit over time. Take a toehold position. If interest rates rise and these companies which have aspirational earnings, meaning their earnings are years out to come, they're going to have the discounted present value of those earnings go down as interest rates go up and their share prices will go down. As that happens, then you add to them. Just please be patient. And Steve, you know this about me. This is, for me, the biggest virtue in investing is being patient. If you've done your homework and you believe the stock is the right stock for you to own, just be patient in terms of when you buy it, how long you hold it, and when you sell it.
Let's do a little education here. Most of our viewers know it, but for those that don't, why their targets? Why very high price to revenue, price to earnings, stocks are targets? You mentioned it. DCF, discounted cash flow model. So when you model those, and when the analysts who are recommending it model it, they assume a certain interest rate. And as that interest rate goes higher, two things happen. Number one, you're competing with assets today that have lower rates, now they're higher rates, so stocks compete with them, number one. Number two, when you plug in that higher interest rate into your DCF model, which go out 5, 10, God forbid, 20 years, but it does, which is realistic, because I have a tough time looking out 2 years in investing. They're looking out 10 or 20. But when you put in that higher interest rate, the value, the present value of those earnings, because they're not trading on today's earnings nor tomorrow's, the present value of those earnings shrinks. It goes lower. So that's why those are always simple targets. Now, the issue that I have is that the market's painting them all with one brush. They're taking tech stocks that are selling at a 12 PE that aren't using a DCF going out 5 years, but rather an actual PE at a big market discount and selling those too because they're tech. And that's the downside of index investing for the market. But it's also the opportunity because you can look at those and you could say, you know what? This is sold off because of some quant, some arb, whatever, and I'm going to buy it. But then you have to be patient.
So let me pick up on that. Another important point. Let's talk about these GARP stocks. Let's talk about the FANG stocks. I can pick anything. I can pick Apple. Here's what I expect for Apple in the coming 2 to 3 years, and here's what I think the markets should expect. It should expect net income, as shown on the bottom line of their profit and loss statement, to go up anywhere between 7 and 9% per annum for the next couple of years. Now, some will say, what are you crazy? Only 7%, 8% on Apple? Yeah, because you know what? This has actually become a mature business selling iPhones and iMacs. However, just don't freak out, everybody, because what you can expect on top of that is with the gargantuan cash flows that come from that, they are going to continue to shrink their share count, as they have been doing. Over the last 6 years, they've shrunk their share count by about 30%. So add another few percentage points on top of that net income, and what you should expect is anywhere from 12 to maybe 15% per annum for the next 2 or 3 years on Apple. Maybe not the 15%, maybe just 12%. Here are some conclusions from that. Hearing that, some people are going to shriek. They're going to say, oh my God, the world is ending. 12% from Apple? That's right, folks. You don't get 45% per annum until the end of your life.
One second. Here's the reality. Most people don't even have a margin target or an earnings target or a revenue target in terms of growth for Apple. They just own Apple and they say, you know what? I got to own this stock. I have no idea what the metrics are. I just got to own the stock. So I don't think as many people will be disappointed as you.
But that's why you and I are here, Steve, is to educate them. I actually do think. I think people...
I'm here to make fun of you and have a good time. Educating is so secondary or tertiary to what I'm doing here.
Okay. Well, I tell you that people are going to be crying to Congress to shut the markets when Apple goes up 10% per annum. By the way, inherent in what I'm saying is you're not going to get multiple expansion on these FANG stocks. You don't need them, by the way. You don't need them. If you got 12% on Apple for the next 2-3 years, that should beat the markets. The market should go up 8-9% over the next 2-3 years. And you should be happy with that, folks. Now, you want to do something better than that? That's why I've been telling you all along, you got to look at these cyclicals right here. The energy, that's a short-term trade. That's 3 to 6 more months of that trade. Financials?
I sold my CVX, which is my only energy holding. I had one other, Magnolia Oil and Gas. Sold that a couple weeks ago. Sold my CVX last week. I think you're sort of at the top. Although the Saudi announcement sort of pissed me off today. When I say Saudi, it was really OPEC, where they came out and said, hey, if our biggest customers release reserves, we will match that. We will retaliate. And that shows you that on a different topic, but always important, always interesting, that why do we sell them arms? They're not friends of ours. They've never been friends of ours. We've got runaway inflation here, although it's coming down a little bit, but still pretty high inflation, and they just want to pile on. The stupidity of that in their part is that the biggest cure for high oil prices are high oil prices. So as long as they continue to ratchet up and take blood from the American people and other civilized nations, then we're just going to go more towards non-oil. So I'm looking forward to coming back at him.
Steve, I'll do Middle East politics with you in a different lifetime.
That was energy politics.
Sorry, I like to laugh at my own jokes. But anyway, let me go back to where I was when you jumped in, and I'm fine with that. The energy trade is not a long-term trade. Okay, we are going to get to green energy.
Never has been.
No, it isn't. But it's been longer than people think. And I do think you've got another 3 to 6 months in this simply because supply-demand analysis dictates it.
Let me ask you a question then. When you say you have another 3 to 6 months, when do you start getting out? Are you saying that oil prices start declining in 3 to 6 months? Or are you saying 3 to 6 months and you have enough time to get out? And by the way, that different 3 months, we've seen oil really get crushed. No, stocks get crushed in a short time frame, a 3 month, a 1 month time frame. So
it could happen.
That's sort of like an eternity, 3 to 6 months.
Steve, it could happen. I'm laying it out here. I'm being very clear in what my statement is. I want to go where I was going with this comment.
Well, let me ask you more questions before you do. So you've made
is there any stopping you? I mean,
no, there's not. Yeah, I'm a force to be reckoned with. So let me ask you this, okay? You've been in energy for a while. You've made a lot of money. You were in it before anybody was. Why be piggish? If it's 3 to 6 months, why not say, hey, I'm getting out. I've made enough money. You need somebody else to come in and take me out while it's still upside.
That's actually a good question. I'm surprised that that would come from you, but okay. What's the weighting of energy in the S&P 500? It's about 3% right now. So I can be double that weighting, which is what I am at 6%, and really not get my tuchus handed to me if I'm wrong on this. By the way, of course I could be wrong, Steve. You could be wrong shorting ARK. I mean, we all know we could be wrong. I'm making my statement, and it really comes down to supply-demand imbalances. But I'm not going to stay at this party too long. What I'm not saying to you is this a multi-year trade. What I will tell you is a multi-year trade, rather investment, is the financials and industrials. And this is the beauty of the infrastructure bill. I'm going to stay away from Build Back Better for now. Okay. The infrastructure bill, which just passed, is spread out over many years to come. And that's the beautiful type of infrastructure of let's get backhoes and clear land and lay some concrete so that our roads are better and our tires don't get flat and our front ends don't need to be aligned and all of that stuff. All right, that is spread out over years. It requires financing. It requires materials. It requires energy. It requires backhoes, industrials. I love that. I love that. Now, you know, my father was a municipal bond guy, so of course I love infrastructure. I think that's something beautiful yet to come. Let me be clear about something, and you're the same with me on this. We're not saying sell your fangs, by no means. We are saying be careful of those hypergrowth stocks, but by no means are we saying sell your fangs. We're just saying, or at least I am, you want better than the market returns, you've really got to look for these cyclicals right now. And I understand, you think energy is a little long in the tooth? I might be wrong on that. Let me tell you one way that I might be wrong, because I do like to see the other side of the trade. China has its Winter Olympics coming up in February. And if you remember, and I'm sure you do, in the Summer Olympics, whenever that was, I don't remember when this was, 2008? I have no actually recollection. In Beijing, they shut down industry for a month. They shut down industry for a month before the Olympics to clear the smog out of their air. Now, I got to tell you, politics, and I'm no Chinese political or cultural expert, but I think it's kind of hard to tell the Chinese people that for a month you're not going to go to work. I find that hard to believe.
Well, first of all, they can tell them anything they want to, and they'll have to listen. But the Winter Olympics has a different climate than the Summer Olympics.
Really, Steve? So, really?
Yes. I'm trying to lay it out easy for you and give you something we can agree on. And hopefully that's, you do agree with that, right? I'm not over my skis here.
Yes, Steve.
So it's less prone to It's less prone to really driving the pollution. They've also been cutting back on their steel production, which has been helpful in terms of the pollution. And we'll see who shows up for their Olympics, because there's talk of protests and boycotting and so forth. But China's kind of interesting, because now they're trying to rein in their currency, which has been sort of strengthening. They don't like to see it strengthen, because that puts them on their back heels in terms of their exports. So they're trying to do something there. They're trying to make Xi president for life, which I'd like to be and think I should be. So I'm going to pay careful attention to how he's able to do that, because I may want to steal a paper.
I'll get you
playbook.
A paper hat.
Thank you very much. And their economy is turning more inward. They're trying to drive, and have been for years, drive a consumption economy. Like U.S. is 2/3 consumption. So we'll see what happens there. But all that aside, China continues to play a very important role in industrials, in metals, the commodities, that some of which you like. And we'll see where it goes, how tensions go. But there's a big problem. You talk about, while we're on foreign powers, you talk about ignoring COVID. What we're really ignoring is Russia massing at the Ukrainian border and perhaps going in there. And why are they doing that? Because Ukraine has the second largest natural gas reserves in all of that region. And so that's what Russia wants. And given how divided this country is, and how divided you're starting to see Europe, of course, pales in comparison to us, and how we're occupied with China, and we're occupied with internal politics, it's sort of carte blanche to Russia to go and do what you want to do, as they did with Crimea. And for them, we'll ask permission later. They're not going to ask permission.
They screwed things up for us in 2014 with the Crimean Peninsula.
Exactly.
Absolutely. I remember. Do you remember all the talk at that point in time of, Europe's coming back? Europe finally, for once, would have above average growth, and that screwed it up. And I think you're absolutely right. We got to pay attention to the Ukraine.
Market did get through it in fairly—
And it will.
14 was a good year. 15 was a flat year.
15 had other problems, had the Chinese yuan devaluation.
Yep.
However— here's what's likely to happen. Now, I'm going to try to stay out of politics here, but I am going to speak as a military man. What we did in Afghanistan told Russia and Putin to just go right ahead. We're not going to do anything to stop you. Sorry, this is a direct result of that. Well, who knows, okay?
Sanctions.
But yeah, exactly. You can't come over and play in New York. No, but what will happen is if this happens, much like in 2014, it will create volatility. By the way, the market is due for some volatility. I'll come back to that in a second.
You got it.
It'll create some volatility, but it's probably not going to upend the overall economic activity of the globe, nor the profit picture. Got a little bit of volatility.
It makes investing in Europe more challenging. Europe has no appetite to go in there and mass at the Ukrainian border to protect them. Ukraine has no friends. It's not because people don't want to help them, but it's because they've got their own problems. And keep in mind that wars are expensive. and nobody wants to allocate that capital to it, nor are there people, more importantly, human lives. And they look at it and say, what are we going to get out of it? We're not going to stop them anyway. So unless you want to go to a regional war or world war, forget about it. But this will be very instructive for China. And China will be taking a look and say, okay, here's what Russia did to Ukraine. Why can't we do this to Taiwan? And I think there are major issues because Taiwan has much more strategic importance to the rest of the world than Ukraine does, number one. Number two, China, we can camp out as we have been in the water, in the straits, and be a barrier there. But still, we talked that last time. That's the biggest concern after the Olympics. They're not doing anything before the Olympics. In my mind, do they move on Taiwan?
Okay, so I'm taking what you're saying, agreeing with it. What this means to me is that the markets are going to experience heightened volatility, but not an interruption of the bull market. What does that mean? First off, let's talk about the volatility regime that we've been living in, which has been very low for a long period of time. Technical definition of a correction in the markets is greater than 10%. We haven't had that, Steve, since the March 2020 downturn at the first stages of the pandemic. Since then, we had a couple of 9% downturns in the fall of 2020. And then we haven't even had worse than a 5% drawdown in the last 14 months or so. Why is that? For me, there's one reason. All right. And this, if you want to take one lesson that I would tell you every single time we talk, not that you need it, but our listeners do need to hear this. Don't fight the Fed. When the Fed is buying $120 billion of bonds every month, that's cash that comes into the financial system, needs to find a home.
$105 billion.
I was about to go there. Okay, so they've started the taper. Now it's $105 billion.
Do you notice something, Jim?
Wait.
When you're about to go somewhere, I'm there first.
No, now you're interrupting a little too much for my liking, okay. But I do appreciate your humor. $105 billion is still a large number. Okay, next month it'll be $90 billion. The month after that, it'll be $75 billion if they don't increase it. Here's the point. Sometime in the first quarter, those numbers are not as big as $120 billion. They're not as big as $105 billion. And I'm not just speaking mathematically. I'm talking in terms of their impact. So you get into the first quarter of 2022, and if you have any catalysts like these ones that we're talking about, you could see a correction. And I'm going to tell you something, Steve, and you know this. People are going to be screaming their heads off. They're going to be crying to Congress to shut the markets because it's been so long since you've seen a correction. Usually we get one a year, sometimes more than one a year. That will be a buying opportunity, folks. We'll be here when that happens. We'll be here to remind you.
You know what's so interesting about markets and what makes it interesting every day is that one point leads to another. So when you talk about the tapering, which is $15 billion per month, that's largely been going into mortgages. So arguably helping the housing market. Is that going to lead to a correction in the housing market as well, even before we get to rate hikes? You and I will agree that the rate hikes aren't going to be significant in the absolute. If we see them sort of like we saw today with that major move in the 10-year, well, then that's something. But the Fed's not going to do that. That's the market saying what the Fed should do. And part of that was technical also today because you've got these massive auctions, the 1-, 3-, 5-, and 7-year auctions inside a 3-day period where typically it's spread out much more because of the holiday week. But back to the question, do you think that tapering ultimately, not now, not next month, pressures the housing market?
Yes, but I think the housing market needs to be pressured. I think we've got a serious housing problem here in the United States. And you read these stories and you hear them all over the place of just young couples who are doing what they're supposed to be doing. They're starting a family, double earners in many cases, who simply can't find an affordable home in the places that they live. That is, unfortunately, the asset inflation that the Fed and the fiscal government wanted coming out of this crisis, but it's gone too far. So it needs to be pressured. I'm not that worried about it as long as job growth is still strong, which right now it looks like it's very strong, maybe even a little too strong. But no, that doesn't worry me. I think we need a little calming down of the housing market. And I do want to pick up on something that you mentioned, which is the Fed potentially raising rates. I want to tell folks now, that's not a reason to get out of the markets. May it increase volatility? Sure, probably will increase volatility. But if you look at the last three interest rate cycles, when the Fed started to raise rates, in each case, you had at least a year. And in the last two cycles, you had more than 2 years of plus 10% per annum growth in the S&P 500 before you had a 20% downturn. Meaning, don't get out of the markets just because the Fed raises rates. It's going to raise rates for the right reasons. Economy's growing. Yeah, there's a little bit of inflation. The economy's growing. They want to normalize interest rates. Even if they get to it sooner, yes, it will increase volatility. It doesn't interrupt the bull market. We'll be here to tell you about that when it happens.
So rates aren't going to hurt the market. Agreed. Markets go up. They've gone up in perpetuity. They'll keep going. We've seen many, many rate hikes. Markets go up when taxes go up. I've seen that data. Even when corporate, individual, and capital gains tax have increased, the market still went up. Crimea, we saw it went up then, so it's going to get wobbled a little bit, so it's going to be fine, Russia's next advance. So what are you worried about? Is the market just never worry about the market? Just always stay mostly fully invested? Mr. All In Jim?
Steve, the odds are in my favor to stay invested.
You certainly
are. By far, you know it. I know. Thanks for that softball pitch. It's unlike you, but I appreciate it. Folks, seriously, the odds are in your favor to be long the market all the time. Now, something will happen. Going into 2020, sure, I'd heard some news reports that there was some strange China virus. I didn't think it was going to do what it did to the global economy. Something like that will happen. Probably not COVID, all right, as we've already talked about. Something else will happen. But it's going to happen like once every 5, 7, maybe 10 years. And during that time, if you're sitting there saying, I'm going to get out of the market because of whatever, the Fed's going to raise interest rates or Russia's going to invade Ukraine, you are so much more likely to get that decision wrong than right. So much more likely. And Steve, I've seen it. I don't believe you've ever worked with retail, maybe earlier in your career. You're mostly
never institutional. Did.
I have worked with retail for my whole life and my family grew up. I'm third generation doing it. When I see clients tell me and direct me at times, hey, you got to get out of the market because this is happening. Trump was elected or this is going to happen or whatever. It's invariably the wrong decision. By the way, I won't do it anymore. When clients tell me to do that, I'm now at an age where I'll say, listen, I have a lot of respect for you, of course, as a person, but I'm not going to abet your wealth destruction. Try not to make it moral. I just try to say, you got to find somebody else because I'm not going to be party to it.
Well, just as rule of thumb, if you've got short-term gains and you sell, then you're paying a sizable tax. So you've got to believe that the market's going to correct more than whatever, 40, 50%, depending upon your tax bracket. So if you have gains, if you have losses, different story. Most people have gains because the market's been so buoyant for so long. If it's on a long-term gain, well, the economics are a little different. But I do believe you should always keep cash. And that's because where you make your money is where you go in and where you eventually sell. So you're not advocating hold on to every position you buy. You're advocating always be long the market. And I agree with that in varying degrees. We have different, shall we say, benchmarks. Yours is the S&P. Yours are retail client base. I don't have either of those. Mine is an absolute return where I've got to make money. Preservation of capital, of course, drives us both. That's the number one tenet of investing. Don't lose money. And after you come to grips with that, then you try to make money in a responsible fashion. But I always keep cash there. I've got the core portfolio, which I rarely touch, but then I trade a portion of it. And that's where I become very opportunistic.
So, Steve, it's a good point, and I want to clarify what I was saying before, because there are times where you can dial back the risk a little bit. So apropos of what I'm saying, we crescendo into the year end, maybe into January, something happens. Yeah, I've been wearing this moniker of Mr. All In. It's been an easy call to make, honestly. Yep. It's been an easy call to make. You get into January, I'm probably going to take a little bit off the table. Now, not a lot. Raise 5, 7% cash. It'll give me the opportunity when a downturn comes to strike and pounce. And if I'm wrong, I'm sitting on a pile of gains anyway, but I haven't made such a move out of the market that if it goes up another 20%, I'm sitting there kicking myself. And without naming any names, which we could, those folks who for the last year and a half have been calling for a 10% correction, I think they are such poor risk takers. The odds are against them. Even if they get it right, the right thing to do would be to just stay in and stay invested and get through that correction. But the downside of being wrong, as many of these folks have been, as they've been waiting for a 10% correction, as the market's gone up, honestly, 45%, they've been missing out on this. It's painful to watch. The point being is that, and I want to make sure this is clarified, if I play around with cash, it's going to be raised 5-7%. It's not going to be saying, hey, let's take 25% out of the market. Let's take 50% of the market. That's how you damage your wealth creation. We've got decades ahead of us of growing our wealth. Stay in the markets, but you got to get through the downturns.
I've been in much higher levels of cash. For example, in and this is not revisionist history, when COVID really started to be an issue, I decided to go to lots of cash. And I wasn't in all cash, but I got very close because I saw the market was up in 2019 by about 32, 34%. And my view was that we were going to give up that entire gain. And that's just the market. As we know, stocks are completely different. Stocks can go down 50 and go down 75 when the market's going up. But when the market's going down, they can go down a similar amount. Similarly, when the market's going down, you can have stocks that are up 25, 50. So it's very bottoms up driven, which is what you and I do. But there are certain points in time where I will be in large, large cash. In other words, frankly, in 08, because I was out of Lehman, but I was still an insider, and I knew what was going on, and the world had no idea what was going on in 08, 09. But you took having come from Lehman and knowing that I was just one big hedge fund. I mean, we literally, every day, had $60 billion worth of balance sheet to put to work. And then under the old rules, you shrink the balance sheet when it's time to report the quarter so that it could look like client revenues. Those wasn't my directive. That was the directive from up above. So it was a large hedge fund that said, we got to gamble every day to generate returns and classify them elsewhere. Now, maybe this is record-breaking. Maybe this is newsworthy. It actually is. I think the story has been told before. But the importance of that is, and this can get back to our analysis, what drives earnings? What drives the multiple on a stock? And the decision was made at Lehman back then that the market doesn't want trading revenues. The market wants sustainable customer revenues. And that's why you saw the big change in Morgan Stanley, where Gorman did a masterful job of going from just purely investment bank to in your business, where there are retail revenues, a lot of wealth management driving it. That's why JP Morgan has not been just a trading firm for a long time, and neither has Goldman. It's these other businesses that drive it. And if you look through other industries, I'm looking at a company right now where it's got two different lines of revenue. I'm not going to say the company here because of things that are going on there, but one is a legacy, slow growth, about 10%, 8 to 10%. The other is growing at about 20%. And the market's ignoring that because they're looking at the legacy business. That's where opportunity is. I didn't mean to go off on a tangent, but my message is you've got to look at where the earnings are coming from, where the revenues are coming from, because in troubled times in the market, believe me, somebody else is going to be looking at it and they're going to get there before you unless you know what's going on.
I'm going to explore your tangent, but then I want to come back to market timing for a second, the folly of that. Because as I was listening to you talk about Lehman and an unnamed financial, I'm thinking about Goldman Sachs, in which I'm invested now.
Me too.
And yeah, great company. And in which I was employed from 1998 to 2004. And I remember that time very carefully. That was a trading time, baby. Late 90s, and those IPOs were coming around and they were slinging them left and right. The stable business, the fee generating client business almost didn't exist. Now, since that time, over the last 20 years, they have morphed quite a bit. They have gotten they still do a great trading business, but when it comes to private clients, it's all fee-based. And not only that, but they've gone down market. When I was there, it was, hey, we just want to have client accounts of $10 million or more. Now you've got Marcus. Now you've gone downscale. And that is their way of expanding the fee-based business to stabilize things. So exactly. And they have these quarters sometimes. You've seen this in Goldman Sachs, where the trading revenues are phenomenal. And the stock goes down because that's not what the market wants. Now, I explored that tangent with you because I felt it was relevant. I want to come back to market timing on something because I was thinking about this as you were talking about 08, 09, and as you were talking about the early stages of the pandemic. And there is a phenomenon when the market goes down hard of saying, I got to get out. I got to get out, man. And here
it's an urge.
Huh?
It's an urge.
Yeah, it is. It's a very normal human reaction. We did a conference call at my firm a few weeks ago, and I trotted out some figures which are well known. If you took the last 20 years and you missed the top 10 days in the market, your annualized return went down by more than half on an annualized basis. I mean, that is criminal.
Astounding.
And of those 10 top trading days, most of them, the majority of them, came within 2 weeks of one of the top 10 losing days, meaning you got to quell that urge. When things go down hard, you got to stay in, baby.
I don't think it's a question of selling. I agree that you don't panic and sell. I mean, there are certain points in time where it's apparent that you should take some off the table. I think, frankly, 2000 going to 2020 with COVID was that when, if you had good information, as I did, being fortunate to know people that had people on the ground and could see what was going to happen, then I think you have to take some money off the table, particularly depends what stocks you're in, because there's no holding onto the airlines. You'd still be underwater despite the massive move in the markets. Here's what I would say. It's not a question of panic to sell. It's a question on the other side, which is not rushing to get in and catching a falling knife. So just as you have to be judicious, and when you take profits, and they're assuming this will be profits, you also have to say, okay, maybe this is going down further. I'm not going to keep putting money in. I'm going to wait for some stabilization. I'm going to wait until I know why the market is down. I'm going to wait till it hits a level where I just can't miss, no matter what happens next year and the year after and the year after that.
So I'm going to disagree with you a little bit.
Let me just tell you where I'm referencing. So when you see a snowflake come down 10% or 15%, I hate to keep picking on that, but it sits right in my screen and I look at it as a warning. When you see a snowflake there, it's a good company. Nothing about the company, nothing about the management, even though I don't think CEO is worth $100 million a month. That's ridiculous, violates every governance standard out there. When you see that, coming down 10% is just not enough. Coming down 15%, again, that's just not enough. And I can go on, but I got it.
I know what you're talking about, Snowflake and Palantir and Unity and Marqeta and all these names, where when I look at them, if I see a stock that is measured on price to sales and the price to sales is measured in multiples of 10, I got a problem. Here's why, Steve. All right. And this is what I talk to clients about. I say, here's why I'm not buying those stocks for you. You tell me, if I buy it at a price to sales multiple of 40 and it goes down to 25 times sales, you've now lost whatever you've lost, about 40% in quick math there. And I'm going to tell you, it's still expensive.
So you need a double.
Well, wait, I'm going to say it's still expensive. And you're going to say, well, why did we buy it at 40 times price to sales? Who knows? There's no answer to that. Now, where I will differ with you a little bit, and this goes back to what we were talking about with the hypergrowth stocks, and I own two of them. I own Twilio and I own Salesforce, okay? I said this at the top of the show. I want to repeat it. If you have identified a great company, Steve, you're absolutely right. Don't try to bottom ticket, okay? But dollar cost average into it over time. This is not a vocabulary that I expect you to embrace. It's not the world you live in. It's the world I do live in with retail clients of, okay, you've identified the company you want to be in, like I've identified Salesforce and Twilio. I piece my way into it. I take a little toehold. If it comes down like Twilio has recently, I add to it.
And I do that as well. Why would you say I don't do that? Why would you say it's not something I'm accustomed to? I do that.
Don't get all offended.
I'm not offended.
You're just telling me how you're waiting and waiting and waiting. I'm just saying, listen, don't try to bottom tick this. Don't try to top tick it either. Just dollar cost average your way into it.
I agree. I'm talking about, I was specifically referencing the high growth. I was making an example. But in terms of markets where there are genuine shocks to the market, you can't pick tops and bottoms. That's clear. I've seen a couple people can do it. One name is Tepper. The other name I work with, Steve Cohen. I'd be in the office sitting on the trading desk because I work for Steve, and I'd see him inside of 10 minutes buy the futures at the bottom, sell them at the top, short them, cover them at the bottom, and do it all over again repeatedly. He had an unusual sense of the markets. But that was back then. Now, with all the algo traders, with all the other market constructs, you can't do that. But no, my point was very simply, when the market's in a free-for-all, when it's a rout, that you don't have to rush in. You don't have to say, oh, it's down 10%, not the market of stock. I'm going to go in. You can sometimes be patient. If you want to put a little in, put a little in. It's on a step function. Don't put it all in and say, I've done my job, because then you'll be very depressed if it keeps going. If you miss it and it just rallies off that point, fine. Then you can buy there.
Let me dice this a little more finely. If you've got a company you believe in, I'm going to take Cisco Systems, okay? Wednesday reported earnings was down big on Thursday. You don't step in on Thursday when it's down. When you have a good company misses a quarter, you give it 2 or 3 days. It was down Friday. Today it's up. Now is your time. You should be getting into Cisco if you don't already own it and you're looking to build a position. This is your entry point right here.
Yeah, I won't be building a position in Cisco anytime soon.
It's too high quality a company for
you. It's too old tech. And I'm not so sure the CEO is such a great CEO. He presents well, he talks well, but at the end of the day, it's a GDP company and there are lots of things he can't control. And I just don't think that's where I'm going to generate excess returns.
Again, perspective here matters. And when I buy a stock like Cisco, pretty much agreeing with what you just said, this isn't going to be Tesla. I'm not saying that for one second. But what am I looking for?
There's something between Tesla and Cisco, by the way.
Well, just slow down, champ. What I'm looking for here is low vol that at least matches the market's return and hopefully beats it. And if you look at Cisco over 5, 7, 10 years, it's done exactly that. It does have these one-year periods where it absolutely stinks up the joint and drives me crazy.
Now, I've looked at the chart.
Yeah. But this is the quintessential steady Eddie. And going back to what we were talking about, taxes.
Why do you say low vol? Why is vol important to you? Because your client base?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Because you're not associating volatility with risk, are you?
No, but well, yes, but in a way that you're not used to, Steve. So let's just take Tesla as a high vol stock. Let me do that for a second. Beginning of this year, it was at 900. Now it's at 1,050. So if you just measured those 2 points, you would say, great stock, except that in between it went to 600. And I've got clients who from 900 to 600 are going to say, get me out. They're going to yell and scream, get me out. That's the risk. Let me define this risk. This is important. It's the risk of taking a temporary loss and turning it into a permanent loss. I have very little risk of that with Cisco.
And do you need me to talk to your clients? Do you need me to come in there and
stay as far away from my clients as humanly possible? But no, for comic relief, maybe. No, but what Cisco does, it is allowing the gyrations of something that's more high vol. Maybe even this Cleveland Cliffs that you know I like, which has done great, but
very volatile.
Very volatile. It dampens out the overall portfolio volatility. That's what Cisco does. It dampens out the overall portfolio volatility while still giving me that S&P 500 beating return so that I can weather cliffs, Cleveland Cliffs in the portfolio. That's why I do it. And it's all investor mentality, Steve. It's all investor mentality.
Yeah, see, so many people equate volatility with risk, and I shake my head. Volatility is not risk. It's opportunity. And you're not going to generate wildly excess returns if you're worried about volatility. Not that you'll generate poor returns, but it's just not going to be something where you can say, hey, I really killed it. But it depends on what your perspective is, what your hurdle is. If you're just looking for 7% and you put up 10%, well, damn it. I mean, that's 50% more than what you were targeting.
Also bear in mind that for the bulk of my clients, they are coming to me, they've already made their wealth. And this is important. They're not coming to me
I would
saying,
hope so.
Okay. I will admit I am sleepwalking into this, but if you can hold off for 15 seconds, okay, then I'll let you make the obvious joke, okay? No, Steve, what I'm saying is they've already made their money through hard work, and they've come to me and they've said, look, I've made this pile of money. I want you to grow it, but I want you to grow it with preservation of capital in mind. I want you to grow it
safely.
Which
is what we said before.
Yeah. They don't want me to use the stock market to make them rich. That's not what they're doing.
And I get that. It's just that the people I talk to, the people I work for, it's just a different perspective. Just as you have buckets in your portfolio, wealthy, very wealthy people have buckets. And they say, I don't care about the volatility there because I know I'm going for real excess returns. But here, I want some more stability. This will be my go-to, my 7%, my 8%, my better than GDP. And then this will be my private equity, and this will be maybe even my Bitcoin. So they bucket where they want to put their capital.
Bitcoin's in a bear market or on the cusp of it.
It could be in a bear market any day, and then be in a bull market.
I know.
But you're right.
Folks can't see me smirking as I'm saying that. I think it's hilarious.
It'll recover. I'm not a fan. I do have some, but it's not going to affect my way of life or even my weekend budget for going out one way or the other.
Well, Steve, I think this is a good opportunity to wish you a happy Thanksgiving and your family and all of our listeners a happy Thanksgiving. Glad we're doing this.
Yeah,
we're
same to
do
you,
this
Jim.
On a
same
pretty regular you. Basis, and we're going to have some fun as we go through the coming quarters and years.
And we're going to have some guests coming up. Maybe it won't be next week. We're still getting our footwork and laying the foundation for what we want to do. But we will have guests. We'll have interesting guests. And so it's going to be lots of fun each week going forward. So please tune back in.
Very grateful to you for listening. Thank you.